from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Ray Suarez, in today for Michael Krasny. Vice President Joe Biden was in San Francisco this week to tout the achievements of the National Cancer Moonshot Initiative, launched by the White House 1 year ago.
Virologists, geneticists, chemical and biological engineers, they weren't all working in unison, but today we've reached an inflection point where they are, and the promise is enormous.
But how will the cancer moonshot fare in the new administration? This hour, we'll examine that question and talk to medical experts about the latest developments in cancer research and treatment. Forum is next, after this. Welcome to Forum on KQED. I'm Ray Suarez, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Michael will be back Tuesday. When the Obama administration unveiled a massive and coordinated national effort to find cures to cancer, it was immediately referred to as a moonshot. Why moonshot? Well, back in the 1960s, President Kennedy promised to land a man on the moon during that decade, and you'll remember from that famous speech at Rice University and his Boston accent, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. Tremendous amounts of scientific talent, money and time were devoted to designing the tools to get a human being to the moon and back alive, which happened in the summer of 1969. In his 1962 speech, the president cloaked the ambitious goal in the language of idealistic human striving, not spending too much time on the Cold War and the space race with the Russians. The cancer moonshot, unveiled a year ago during the State of the Union address and led by Vice President Joe Biden, takes researchers not to the faraway burning surface of the Earth's orbiting moon, but deep inside us to the smallest mysteries of human life, the wet, warm world where cells frantically reproduce until they kill the body where they live. Kickstarted with a multi-billion dollar initiative, the so-called cancer moonshot targets a disease that only a short time before had killed Vice President Biden's son, Beau. The moonshot brought the vice president to San Francisco earlier this week. What is it? How does it work? Will it survive the transition to the Trump administration just over a week away? On its one-year anniversary, we'll try to answer all those questions. We'll talk with a number of experts, but I want to begin with Matthew Ong, a writer for The Cancer Letter, a newsletter devoted to cancer research. Our number in San Francisco, 866-733-6786. Our email address for your questions, forum@kqed.org. Matthew Ong, welcome to Forum. How's the moonshot doing 1 year later?
Thank you for having me. It's doing well, I think. Vice President Biden is trying to form a nonprofit going forward. But over the past year, he has made, I think a lot of people argue he has made many strides in especially two areas, in data sharing and on FDA improvements to FDA's regulatory processes.
Before the president unveiled this plan, what was different about the way cancer research was coordinated, funded, targeted? It seemed like as a country and as a world, we had taken the let a thousand flowers bloom approach, and there were competing teams and research institutions and funding streams, and everybody was busy at work trying to find something.
Yeah, well, in terms of research funding, I don't think necessarily much has changed in terms of the federal investment through NIH, through the National Cancer Institute. But what's really important is the moonshot has brought a lot of focus into how data sharing can actually improve cancer discovery. So just this week, NCI unveiled a new, what they call a new drug formulary to sort of match make academic cancer centers with pharmaceutical companies to sort of bring combination drugs together and test them together without having to go through years long. You know, sometimes these negotiations can take a very long time. But in that regard, it's sort of bringing a lot of people to the table and getting them to cooperate on different things in research.
Do we know yet? Have we had clear signals yet from the Donald Trump transition team about the state of play going forward after January 20th?
We don't know, actually, and we're not the only ones to not know. It appears that a White House moonshot task force has not heard from the Trump transition team either. So it's up in the air. I mean, we have 1 week left. We don't know whether he will commit to maybe renewing the presidential memorandum on the moonshot or whether he will assign somebody to help support the efforts going forward. But what we do know is Vice President Joe Biden is not giving up on the effort at the end of the administration.
Matthew Ong is a writer for The Cancer Letter. Our number again, 866-733-6786 for your questions about the cancer moonshot and these ambitious goals for solving some of the riddles of a disease that touches so many Americans. We're also joined by Alan Ashworth, president of the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Care Center at UCSF. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Deborah Mayer, professor at the School of Nursing and director of cancer survivorship at the Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Deborah Mayer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Ashworth, what did the moonshot idea represent that was really a departure from what was going on before?
Well, for me, it was a renewed focus in the key issues that surround cancer. And these issues have changed over time. So the issue of data sharing that Matthew mentioned wasn't a problem a while ago because we didn't really have complex data. But now our ability to unravel the human genome and tumor genomes at unprecedented pace means there are now tens of thousands of cancer genome sequences available, each of which has 3,000 million bits of information in it. So you start to put these things together, they start to become a great resource for everybody to look at. And previously, we've been very siloed in the way we do that. The great advantage of looking at things together is you can see patterns that you can't see in smaller data subsets. So there's a project that's just been launched by the AACR, the American Association of Cancer Research, called Project Genie, that just released the sequence of 25,000 cancer genomes. This has never happened before. And in my view, this has
been... That never happened before because if an institution spent the money to sequence that genome, that was proprietary information. It didn't want to share it with other places?
Yeah. I mean, and it's not just that they didn't want it. I mean, people wanted to keep the information because they wanted the victory. They wanted the win. But actually, I'm a cancer center director, and I literally go to prison if I share inappropriate data. There are laws about this kind of thing put in place, as Joe Biden admits, by the administrations that have gone before and the current one. And what they're now trying to do is figure out ways in which we can access this data without compromising personal information. And of course, the best data you've got is the richest data. You want to know everything about that patient, which includes all their personal information. So there's now a movement to help patients share their data for the common good. Patients are now volunteering their own information in a way that we've never seen before. Again, I think propelled forward by the spirit of the moonshot, a renewed approach to the entire problem.
Deborah Mayer, do we have to be careful when we target cancer, cancer which isn't a single disease caused by a single cause like smallpox, where you're not going to wipe it out, you're not going to stop people from getting it? It's not like targeting other human maladies, is it?
Well, it's more complex, but we have made tremendous progress. When you look at the incidence and mortality rates for cancer statistics, you'll see in the 1990s where we started to have a really big downward curve from lung cancer because we learned how to help people stop smoking. However, you know, a certain percentage, around 20%, 18% of the U.S. population still smoke. And targeting teenagers with e-cigarettes, those are health behavior issues that we see benefits of 10 and 20 years down the line. And we're also thinking about that for the HPV vaccines in children to prevent not only cervical cancer, but head and neck cancers. So although there may be more refinement and the specificities of the things that we're talking about, we also know that obesity is becoming the new tobacco because of its significance in contributing to cancer. And so, again, we have to start looking now as to how we turn that around, and we will see benefits in the next 10 and 20 years if we're able to do those things.
Because I don't want to be pedantic, but I wonder whether we're selling the public an idea that maybe isn't quite right. If cancer is becoming more survivable, but also we as a society are getting to be an older society, aren't a lot more people going to have cancer because it's so commonly a disease of old age? In fact, that so many people live long enough to develop cancer is a sign that something remarkable has happened. You can expect to see your 70th birthday and increasingly your 80th.
We expect an increase, but it's not the rates are increasing. It's the fact that there's a sheer tsunami of baby boomers coming through that we will see more people with cancer, but we're actually making progress in the rates per 100,000 people is declining. So if you didn't see this increase in baby boomers coming through, you wouldn't see that big increase. But we've been anticipating that for a while now. And I think that a lot of the things that I've been on a number of these committees, I've been an oncology nurse for 40 years and a cancer survivor for 10. I've been on a number of these committees, and I've never been on one that has been this energizing and this exciting because it's looking at things we can do today and tomorrow that can improve both the quality of life of people who are already living with cancer. And we would have 15.5 million survivors in the country now, and that's going to grow to 20 million survivors. So we have to anticipate what it's like to help them live with what they've had better, as well as focusing on the prevention end, as well as focusing on how do we understand and target the treatment better as we understand the cancer better. So I think it's the 60,000-foot level rather than the 30,000-foot level of identifying those areas that will yield the greatest advancements in the shortest amount of time. And I think that's what's been different. We were challenged to really think differently about what was going to be the highest return on investment, not that other things aren't important, but that if we were able to do these things, we would accelerate the progress we're making.
Yeah, so I think that's really important points. We tend to think of a moonshot as being this shiny, high-tech thing that we're building, you know, with new fancy drugs. But actually, and people are very surprised often by this number, but between 30 and 40% of cancer is preventable with what we know now. If we simply implemented that now, we would make a tremendous difference. And in fact, 3 months ago with Mayor Ed Lee in San Francisco, we launched a new program called SFCAN, which attempts at a citywide level to implement as many of these things as possible. And it's not the problem is not knowing what to do. It's knowing how to implement it. How do you help people stop smoking? How do you help people get access to colorectal cancer screening? How do you screen for the viruses that cause cancer and then help them get cured of hepatitis C? It's not, I mean, it's not a joke. It's not rocket science. It's actually stuff that is readily done. We just don't concentrate on it enough.
I looked, Matthew Ong, at the long portfolio of initiatives that fall under the umbrella of the Cancer Moonshot. They're dazzling in their diversity. Some, as Deborah Mayer mentioned, in post-treatment, some in the research area, some in the treatment area. A lot of things count as part of the Moonshot.
Mm-hmm. And there were over 70 initiatives, I think, that were launched or announced or endorsed and highlighted by the Moonshot. I think just going back to what Deborah was saying and to your question about overpromising, so when President Obama announced the Moonshot a year ago, I think half of, or maybe nearly all of oncology were like, oh, not again, another Moonshot in cancer. And the history of moonshots in cancer have not exactly been, number one, the most respectful to science or the best for patients because there is the risk of overpromising. But what is unique about this moonshot is from the outset, Vice President Biden said, "I'm not naive. We are very quick to caution you that we would not be overpromising, because cancer is an evolutionary and a biological process. You know, it has to follow a stepwise process that science gives you." But Biden specifically said, "We're going to do things that we can achieve, and that's through two ways, you know, by doing data sharing, which is strictly an engineering problem, really, if you think about it, and by looking at FDA processes for regulating cancer products, so which is engineering, but in a bureaucratic sense. So what they did, what the two most notable things that he was trying to do is, number one, is to try and address what the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act of 2009 did, which is the stimulus package that the Obama administration passed. They gave $35 billion to the electronic health record industry to sort of move everyone into the medical record era digitally. And the second thing is to sort of bring all of FDA's different cancer-related departments together under one dedicated cancer center. And that's another great achievement that they had, which is to create the FDA Oncology Center of Excellence.
Matthew Ong writes for The Cancer Letter. He joins me along with Deborah Mayer, who was appointed to the Blue Ribbon Panel for the Vice President Biden Cancer Moonshot Initiative. And we're also joined by Alan Ashworth. He was the first director of the Breakthrough Breast Cancer Research Center at the Institute for Cancer Research. The number is 866-733-6786. We'd especially like to hear from those members of our audience who've experienced cancer firsthand, either as a patient or as a caregiver. What do you want the moonshot to focus on? Anthony's with us now from Concord. Anthony, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call with all of your guests. I actually have my father passed away 3 years ago from stage 4 pancreatic cancer. 5 years before that, my grandmother passed away of stage 3 ovarian cancer, and this past year I had a couple of lymph node removals which had benign tumors in them, thank goodness. So, you know, I have a vast, you know, history with cancer in my own family. But what I wanted to ask was, you know, with all the billions of dollars being spent, you know, towards cancer research, why don't we go towards the cause of cancer? You know, in my opinion, it's the overabundance of chemicals that we're exposed to day in and day out, from what we drink, what we breathe, to what, you know, what we spray on our countertops, what makeup we put on our face. I mean, doesn't that give rise to cancer? I mean, we look at GMOs. We don't really know if they're safe for us or not. You know, the WHO labels them carcinogenic, but, you know, the FDA says they're safe because they're a bunch of, you know, full of a bunch of former pharmaceutical executives. I mean, when is this going to stop? How many people need to die before we actually, you know, resolve this problem?
Alan Ashworth, could we, as Anthony suggests, achieve a great reduction in onset just by getting control on what's out there in our environment that we put there?
Yeah, and the answer is absolutely. The number one cause of cancer in the world is tobacco. That is a chemical which we put in our bodies, and that causes lung and other cancers. Second chemical, alcohol. We put that in our bodies. There may well be other chemicals that cause cancer, but they are small, probably, compared to those two. You'd add in asbestos as well through ship workers and builders. Still a huge problem, a chemical that's out there that we can do something about, that's still unregulated in many parts of the world. So I don't, for a second, I'm not minimizing what the caller is saying about chemicals, and there may well be other chemical causes of cancers, but we really know how to tackle most of this problem now, and it's those factors that I've talked about.
Deborah Mayer, if you want to use a compound in manufacture, in a consumer item, in building materials, you can start using it without any screening. The screening is done after the fact.
That's something that certainly needs to be addressed. The Blue Ribbon Panel's charge was to look at those things that would yield the greatest improvement in the fastest way. That doesn't mean that work isn't already going on at different federal agencies to explore the chemicals or look at their carcinogenesis. But again, we were focusing on those that were going to return the highest rate of return in the short run, which is the tobacco, the obesity, the alcohol, the other things. But there is work going on looking at those. Now, whether it means that we need to change some of our regulatory statutes about how things get reviewed and approved, I think that the moonshot identified barriers that need to be addressed amongst the federal agencies. And Vice President Biden had 18 federal agencies at the table every 2 weeks for this past year about looking at those kinds of things and how they can cooperate and collaborate better amongst themselves. So I can't answer specifically about where reviewing chemicals is in this process, but I do know that there's been a lot of talk about how to collaborate more efficiently to do that.
Santa Rosa, California is next. Christine, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi. Yeah, so I'm a thankful cancer survival, and I feel very blessed to have had one that was highly treatable. But I'm curious to have the speakers talk a little bit about palliative care. I think there's a lot of fear related to cancer, and in some cases that might be some rebranding that we need to do, and also respecting some of the cancers that aren't as treatable and focusing more on the quality of life than the quantity of life for some patients as they get closer to the end.
Ah, boy, that opens a big, big can of worms. Alan Ashworth?
Sure. I think we do need to pay much more attention to how patients feel during their treatment and how we can palliate the nasty side effects of many cancer treatments. So palliative care implies some, end-of-life aspect. I think, you know, we often talk at UCSF about symptom management, so mitigating those awful side effects of chemotherapy and thinking about the whole patient. And I'd add in there the financial consequences of having cancer as a side effect as well. Some people are cured of cancer but financially ruined. And we need to think about that, too.
Deborah Mayer, you mentioned you've been an oncology nurse for a long time. Have best practices changed in keeping patients comfortable and well?
Dramatically, but not enough. So we have not made the same level of progress in symptom management as we have in the basic sciences or in cancer treatments. And that exactly is the reason why we have one of the recommendations from the Blue Ribbon Panel specifically on symptom management. Because we know, and this covers palliative care, survivorship, and end of life, and palliative care is really a focus on symptom management throughout the cancer diagnosis, no matter where you are. And the end of life is more towards advanced cancers that may not be responsive to treatment anymore. But we raise it up to symptom management because that affects everybody from the time of diagnosis, no matter whether they're going to be cured of their cancer, whether they're going to be living with their cancer, or whether they're going to be facing end-of-life challenges. And that's where we really need some investment in science, as well as dissemination and implementation of what we already know. For example...
Well, I'm going to get the example after this break. We'll continue our conversation about the $1 billion initiative known as the Cancer Moonshot. What questions do you have for our guests? Do you have a personal story to share about how cancer has affected your life or those of around you? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Michael Krasny. And you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Ray Suarez, in today one last time for Michael Krasny. We're talking about the multi-billion dollar initiative known as the Cancer Moonshot. If you have questions for our experts or a personal story to share about how cancer has changed your life, give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're joined now by Jan Liphart, Associate Professor of Bioengineering at Stanford. He's also the co-founder of cancerbase.org, a website which allows cancer patients to connect with other patients around the world. Jan Liphart, welcome. Why is that an important part of this?
Good morning, Ray. Thanks for having me. About 2 years ago or so, I had a conversation with a cancer patient, and she said, you know, Jan, I like your research. How do I give you all my medical data? And I said, you know, that's really great. I totally appreciate it, but I have no idea of how you would actually want to do that. And that was really surprising to me. Here we were sitting in Silicon Valley, and if you look at the world around you, billions of people are sharing ideas and pictures and timelines and tweets and movies. And I was sitting across from this patient who wanted to share her data with researchers, and I had absolutely no idea what to tell her. And that was really, really surprising to me. And so what we did is a few scientists came together, including Peter Kuhn at USC and Russ Altman at Stanford, and we put cancerbase.org together. So it's up and running, and you can go there and give information, and we'll share it globally if you want us to.
Were there any regulatory hurdles, some insurance questions, HIPAA questions that you had to navigate before you put up a website where people are sharing medical information?
Well, that was certainly what my wife told me is, Jan, what are you doing? How is this possible? Please don't get into trouble. And
well, she cares about you, Jan.
Yeah. Well, no. Of course. I mean, if you're in a sort of medical world or in research world, as Ellen mentioned earlier, you know, your primary concern is patient confidentiality. And that makes total sense if you're in the academic world or research world. But a cancer patient can do whatever he or she wants with their data. So, for example, if you have breast cancer, you can wear a pink T-shirt that says, I have breast cancer, and you can put this picture on Facebook. And, of course, no one is going to come after this cancer patient. And so once cancer patients realize that they can share whatever they want with whomever they want. And if you have that patient perspective, then a lot of difficult legal issues all of a sudden become very, very simple. So if you're patient-driven, they can do whatever they want. And so our role is as a tool or as a facilitator that helps cancer patients do whatever they like to do.
So wider availability, simpler availability, for what? Where does this lead in 2, 5, 10 years?
Well, so those are great questions. And let me give you a simple example. If I ask you a very, very simple question like, how many people on Earth right now have lung cancer? You're not going to be able to give me an answer. You might be able to pull up data from 2013 or maybe 2014 if you're lucky. But that's really, really strange because these days we can share and transmit information almost instantaneously. And imagine it were possible to right now ask every single cancer patient on Earth, how are you doing? How is your treatment working? And imagine tools like that existed, and then all of a sudden a question that would be very, very difficult to answer with traditional tools becomes very, very easy. And so one thing we'd like to do is to be able to provide real-time information about cancer to anyone who's interested, teachers and poets and scientists and politicians. And something like that was probably entirely inconceivable even a few years ago. But today, from a pure technology perspective, that's not really so difficult at all.
Jan Liphart is an associate professor of bioengineering at Stanford. He's a co-founder of cancerbase.org, a website that allows cancer patients to connect with other patients around the world. Jan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Our number, 866-733-6786. Caroline is in Truckee, California. Caroline, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to share my story a little bit. My older brother passed away from cancer 2 years ago, and he was 35 at the time. And he really struggled with being a young adult who was diagnosed with cancer. I mean, usually you really hear about young children or older adults. And for him, he had a hard time kind of juggling this life of being in treatment, but also carrying on his normal daily life, being a young adult and really kind of finding his place in the world. And he was also really outdoorsy. He loved to ski and go biking and everything and play in the mountains, and that was really what brought him life.
Was it an unusual form of the disease, Caroline, or one of the big commonly acquired ones?
It was incredibly rare. He had synovial sarcoma. And so along with kind of struggling with that isolation of being a young adult, and he didn't know any other young adults who had cancer, also having this really rare form of cancer that a lot of doctors didn't really know how to treat him. He got to a point where a lot of his doctors didn't know what else to do. And so that was a big struggle for him as well. And he actually founded an organization called Send It Foundation, which connects young adults who are battling cancer and brings them together to get outside and connect and really feel alive in the outdoors. Even though they're sick, they can still go skiing and form this community of young adults who are all going through this, who might not know someone else who is going through it. So I just wanted to kind of bring that idea to the table of that there are a lot of these people who are in this time of their life that are struggling just on their own, kind of figuring out, like, where do I fit in? You're maybe starting a new job, you're getting married, you're figuring that life out, but then all of a sudden you're diagnosed with this debilitating disease, and kind of how to go about that. And I think that the Send It Foundation, which he formed, is trying to connect those people together and bring them some life back.
Deborah Mayer, I was caught by something that Caroline said earlier, that her brother perceived himself as being in a very small group, because we hear about children and older adults. Is he really in a smaller group, or is it just the way we talk about and hear about cancer that means someone who's 35 and in this case suffering from a fatal form of the disease is an outlier?
Well, first let me say, Carol, I'm sorry about your loss. I mean, that age group is particularly devastating when they have to face cancer. And it is a much smaller group, and they don't quite fit into pediatrics anymore. And they're not quite in the average age group of other cancers. There are a number of groups like what your brother started, but others. There's an online group called Stupid Cancer, and it's for adolescents and young adults, which is usually considered between 15 and 39. And the issues that they address are very different because they're in a life stage, finishing school, getting a job, thinking about getting married or not, having children or not, that are unique to that population. And sometimes their outcomes aren't as good either because they've not participated in as many clinical trials as pediatric cancer survivors have. So we definitely need to make greater progress. There was an Institute of Medicine report looking at just this topic a few years ago. I think that raised people's sensitivity and awareness to this as an issue, because any one institution may only have a couple of people in this age group. So it's really hard to feel like you're a part of a larger group because it is so rare.
Is a kind of loneliness, a kind of isolation, part of what you suffer when you're going through what Caroline's brother suffered?
Absolutely. The good thing is that age group is usually very technologically savvy, and so there's more ways to connect online through Facebook or other groups, and Cancer Space may, offer some opportunities like that. There's other online groups that do that as a way to meet. And then, like, for example, in North Carolina, we offer programs where they can do an outward bound kind of program and get some together, and it may only be 5 or 10 people that go away for a week together. So, again, at any one institution, there may not be enough, but in a region, there may be more people who can physically get together, but certainly online or in other ways can connect that way.
Deborah Mayer, Matthew Ong, and Alan Ashworth are with me for the rest of the way. If we were to look at this set of goals, Alan Ashworth, and apply public health principles, the best ideas about public health principles, it's a big, expensive set of diseases. Do you go after the treatable ones first? Because there's a finite amount of money. The ones that we know are treatable and try to sharpen up there and save lives that way. Right now, some of the treatments are incredibly expensive and high tech, so aren't widely applicable in a population where there are limits to how much money we can spend. Do rare cancers, like Caroline's brother, end up getting orphaned? Because when we look broad and say, okay, how do we save the largest number of lives, we leave some of these more rare forms of the disease out. I mean, how do you square some of those challenges?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of trade-offs that are potentially in what you've just said. But let's address the rare cancer issue first. If you've got a rare cancer, there's not, by definition, there's not many examples of it. But if you put all the rare cancers together, that's actually a common cancer. Many, many people have rare cancers. So it's not, we think about the big killers of breast and lung and colorectal, but a significant proportion of people have rare cancers. And we don't place as much focus on those. And cancer itself, even breast cancer, is a collection of different diseases. So we're increasingly thinking of the subsetting of cancer. And almost every cancer is a collection of rarer subtypes. And we need to be targeting the therapy to the specific subtype. We're getting better at doing that, but we're not all the way there. So what do we focus on? Well, I think there's the cancers in which we've made least progress really need more attention. We've seen some progress in lung cancer through immunotherapy, but with pancreas cancer, for example, the advances are measured in weeks or months over the last 25 years, weeks or months of survival. And that really is shocking. We've all made almost no progress. So I think we really need to start thinking about new ways of attacking those kinds of diseases, as well as continuing to make the progress in diseases like breast cancer, where survival is so much better than it was a few years ago.
Livermore, California is next. Lonnie, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much for this program. I really appreciate it. I wanted to say I was caregiver for my oldest sister who went to a cancer treatment center, mostly for palliative reasons. But just an observation. There's a great deal of cancer treatment center ads on the TV, which I find odd, a little disconcerting. But she was covered by both Medicare and her husband's health insurance. What happens to the possibilities of the cancer moonshot if Paul Ryan's plan to eliminate Medicare and replace it with the voucher system and the removal of the ACA happens? What happens to the possibilities for people to even hope for a moonshot and to be take advantage of the possibilities that come from it?
Well, Lonnie, an extremely pertinent question, given President-elect Trump's promise that he would move ahead as quickly as possible to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Matthew Ung?
Yeah, I think the concern here is not going to be so much as to whether the moonshot continues, but whether people will be able to get reliable cancer treatment that they can pay for or insurance companies can pay for if the Affordable Care Act is repealed and not replaced promptly. Some experts say that they expect the death rates from cancer to rise, if they don't have insurance to pay for it, or if they can't, if they don't have an incentive to go and get treatment. So that's going to be the primary concern.
One of the features of the Affordable Care Act is pre-existing conditions. You are not able to be denied insurance for pre-existing conditions. And one of the problems that people with a history of cancer find before the Affordable Care Act went into place is that they were locked into whatever they had, if they had anything at all. The other feature of the Affordable Care Act that's valuable to cancer survivors is that there's no lifetime cap. So if you were a child who needed a bone marrow transplant, you may have already hit your lifetime cap. And without that, they would not be able to continue to get health care through the rest of their lives. So whether the Affordable Care Act stays or goes, whatever replaces it, if that's what happens, needs to account for the things that were in there that really were very beneficial for people with either facing cancer or had cancer. And that includes, the screening for cancer and other features that are in the Affordable Care Act.
Lonnie, thanks a lot for your call from Livermore. Walnut Creek is next. Sue, welcome to Forum.
Thank you, everybody. Hello. I'm curious, in addition to cirrhosis, which a lot of us are aware of, I have heard that any amount of alcohol does, in fact, increase the risk of 6 other cancers and possibly one more. Can you clarify, please?
Alan, you want to take that one?
Sure. So there is now pretty good evidence that alcohol can increase your risk of certain cancers. But we have to put these things in perspective, and it's all about relative risk and absolute risk. So relative risk means the proportional increase, and then absolute risk means in a population, what is your exact risk? And with certainly with breast cancer, I believe the data now is fairly compelling that women who drink larger amounts of alcohol are at higher risk of breast cancer. But we also have to balance the risk of alcohol with all the other factors that are at play. For example, with breast cancer, we know that the time a woman has her children, the age at which she has her children, affects that risk, as does the number of children and the amount of breastfeeding. So all alcohol goes into the mix of all other factors. But it is, I think, my belief is that it is now a proven cause of increase of risk.
Sue, thanks a lot for your call. We're getting a lot of interesting feedback from our website. William writes, "My mother died from ovarian cancer almost a decade ago. I'm not sure what was worse, driving her to her treatments and watching her doctor put on a face of hope when there was none, or knowing there's a place called Cancer Centers of America." Kyle tweets, "Oncologists may be dismayed by another moonshot, but isn't this better than another awareness campaign?" Richard asks, "I'd like to know how the San Francisco Cancer Initiative with UCSF fits into the federal cancer moonshot." Well, that's an easily answered question.
Sure. Well, we initiated started the planning for SFCAN, the San Francisco Cancer Initiative, prior to the moonshot. But I had the opportunity of discussing SFCAN with Vice President Biden when he visited UCSF last year. And it really is, as you can see by how the moonshot is described, it's perfectly consistent with what the moonshot is intending to do on a national level. We're doing the initiative here now in San Francisco, really to take control of our locality. Hopefully, with what we learn, we can broaden out beyond the Bay Area and beyond.
One very specific question from a listener: 3-bromopyruvate, 3BP, a fast-acting, promising, powerful, specific, and effective small molecule anti-cancer agent. Are there trials underway with 3BP? Any of our guests?
Wow, know? That's a very specific question. yes, I do recall I've seen the publications on 3BP. Those trials, I believe, are ongoing. The preclinical data, that means before it gets into people, was quite interesting. But we've seen many drugs fail at the clinical level, either because they don't work very well or because they're too toxic. I think it's just too early to say with that particular agent.
Deborah?
You can go to clinicaltrials.gov and put that agent in, and you will see whatever human trials may be going on, because that's a way you can look up by disease or by treatment or what have you what clinical trials are going on around the country. So that would be another source to look at.
Kevin comments, "Sounds like Ms. Mayer is speaking to a need to increase survivorship by maximizing preventive measures. This is great, except for the fact that it says virtually nothing of the forces that have contributed to extreme racial and economic disparities in cancer morbidity and mortality. How do we address the economic, stress, and environmental markers that identify the sources of cancer and poverty as being one and the same?" Deborah Mayer?
There is a great area of work where people are looking on how to close health disparities. And some of those are closing dramatically and some not so dramatically. One of the biggest areas that we're expecting to see some benefit from is with the Affordable Care Act and free prevention services, that we may not see the benefit of that for another 5, 10, 15 years. But people are very aware and very sensitive to health care disparities and why certainly African Americans and other groups may not be benefiting in the same way as Caucasians are. And part of that is access to health care.
Oakland is our next stop. Mason, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I didn't catch all of this, so my apologies if I sound redundant on another question. But I have a couple things. One, as a young plumber, you know, coming up in the trade, I'm definitely aware of building materials and so on and so forth that definitely, you know, can affect us. I'm aware of the Prop 64 on, like, basically everything in California now. But I'm more concerned with, you know, the rise in consumer electronics. We have a lot more, you know, things being broadcast, a lot more frequencies, a lot more, the airwaves are a lot more full. And I'm just kind of curious on what effect that might be contributing to, you know, a rise.
Mason, are you talking to me right now on a cell phone?
I am.
Okay.
But I'm also wearing a radiation-free headset. Of course, I'm also wearing it in my breast pocket. So, you know, that's probably not helpful. secondly, just a quick point, if we can. I don't want to take up too much time.
Very quickly, but, please.
How much is the site's called like crispycancer.com about changing your diet dramatically in order to not have to go through chemo and things like that, as far as allowing your body to give it the power to fight off cancer cells itself, as opposed to you know, anything external trying to do that.
Two good things to follow up on. Thanks a lot for your call, Mason. Let's talk about first cell phones. Will research continue into not only cell phones, but the radiation and the electric frequencies, the RF that's in the air, all these things that Mason mentioned?
Yeah, and there's a whole new mix of things out there because of modern telecommunications and microwave ovens and all sorts of things. There's been a lot of research, particularly into cell phones and cell phone towers, and there is the evidence suggesting a link with cancer is either non-existent or really very weak. I know people always want to think there's something to do with it, but there just really is no evidence to suggest that link. Whether the, you know, anything else, again, it's fairly flimsy, weak evidence. Or non-existent. So I wouldn't be over worried about those kind of things. The dietary things I think are really interesting. I certainly wouldn't think that you'd want to forego chemotherapy and change your diet. That would seem to me to be really rather dangerous. But stimulating the immune system, of course, you know, we've over the last few years, we've now become accustomed to the really big breakthroughs in harnessing the immune system to fight cancer. And, of course, many cancer patients are treated with chemotherapy that really thrashes their immune system, and that might be driving things in the wrong direction. So we really need to think of ways of better carefully stimulating the immune system. If you overstimulate it, you get autoimmunity, which can be very, very serious. But there is a point, an important point in diet and the immune system.
Deborah Mayer, before we go, you're on the commission that oversees the moonshot. What will you be looking for in 2017 to get a signal from the Trump administration about how it plans to proceed?
Well, funding for the moonshot was included in the 21st Century Cures Act that was just passed in the lame duck session. That guaranteed funding for this year and pledge funding in future years, but that remains to be seen whether it will actually be delivered. So I think, first of all, the two biggest concerns is, will the moonshot funding continue beyond this 1 year, which will be needed if we're really going to build on the promises that are in that report. And the second is, what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act, and can we still, if we don't continue it, at least preserve the things that were cancer-friendly in the sense of helping people get the care they needed, helping people get the prevention and the screening that they need so that we can continue to see benefits in those areas. There is going to be a conference next June which will look at what progress has been made so far to try and hold things accountable and looking at those. But those are the two biggest concerns that I have.
Matthew Ong, we've got about a minute left. You cover cancer, but you also cover Congress. You're in Washington. Is there a big constituency for heavy funding of research into cancer?
Definitely. I mean, Congress, I think Congress right now is probably as bipartisan as you can get when it comes to support for biomedical research and investment in that area. But going off what Deborah was saying, what's another main point that we need to look out for in Congress is making electronic health records interoperable. And what that means is patients can take their records anywhere, you know, to get a second opinion from another doctor or to a researcher so that it can contribute to discovery. And the 21st Century Cures Act that Deborah mentioned has a clause in it that requires all these EHR companies to make their data, their medical records transferable. So the moonshot has done a lot of great things for data sharing in research, but we have to see whether 2017 will have progress in terms of making medical records more transferable.
If you want more on this topic, we've put up links to the websites mentioned throughout the show, clinicaltrials.gov, cancerbase.org. On our website, kqed.org forum, I want to thank my guest, Deborah Mayer. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
She's the director of cancer survivorship at the Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Alan Ashworth, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Alan Ashworth is president of the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Care Center at UCSF. And Matthew Ong, a pleasure to have you along.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Matthew Ong writes for The Cancer Letter. Earlier, we spoke to Jan Liphart, associate professor of bioengineering at Stanford and co-founder of cancerbase.org. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, executive producer Holly Kernan. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks a lot.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.